Fourth and final hour on this Tuesday afternoon, Darren, Donick, and Chase. Don't forget Predators tonight, hosting the San Jose Sharks, a 7:30 puck drop. Pete and Hal will have your call. I will have pregame for you at 6:30. Everything heard right here on these airwaves. Darren McFarland, Willie Donick, Chase McCabe with you. We now head over to West End like we do every Tuesday at this time. We bring in Vanderbilt football coach Clark Lee. Coach, how you doing?
Doing well. How are you guys doing?
Doing fantastic. Beautiful day here in Middle Tennessee. And I was kind of reading, we've obviously been on the air. You talked to the media today and, you know, you were just discussing some of the things. And we've had this conversation with you before about when these type of games happen early on in your coaching tenure. You talked about picking yourself up off the mat, dusting yourself off. Obviously, I'm paraphrasing some of this and getting back after it. Was that kind of the message to your team?
But that sounds like a country music song I was listening to earlier, actually. Total ownership, right? We look at the game. We see, a start that had a chance to be competitive. Like always, you know, for us right now, we're not to the point as a program where we're going to line up and just be better. And so we have to find advantage in anticipating where the ball is going to go, having great eye discipline and taking space around the ball. And that's defensively. I felt like we kind of reverted back to a little bit of the Georgia game where it felt like we were chasing the ball around a little bit on the perimeter. I think after the first couple drives, we settled in, and that's when we needed to really counterpunch. 10-3, we get a turnover at the 35-yard line going in, and we proceed to turn it right back over. And then we have the roughing the punter there after the overturn interception. Those are back-to-back-to-back sequences, and those are things that we need to be able to do, capitalize on momentum, and build a lead in the game, and we weren't able to do it. Never were able to get offensive drives going. We were 1 of 11 on third down, which is, you know, a recipe for disaster for us right now, because this needs to be a game control operation. We need to get to the fourth quarter and be within one strike. We just weren't able to do those things. And so you look at them, you own them as coaches, and you say, okay, how can we teach this better? How can we use these situations as ways to deepen understanding of what complementary football is and, you know, with the details of execution. We have to find, explosive plays or just chunk plays in our base plays on offense. You know, we have to stop designing our chunks. It's got to be an inside zone that we block up well and that we're able to crease, or a quarterback run that we're able to pull and find the space and puncture. And those plays are available. You know, rhythm and timing passing, getting the ball out of our hand to an open receiver, which could have happened on Saturday, but we weren't able to make the read, weren't able to make the throw. And until we take ownership of those things, right, we leave ourselves exposed to the possibility of a result like Saturday. And it's frustrating and it's painful, but it's also, you know, parts of the early learning for this program.
Clark, you kind of touched on where I was going next. It sounds like heavy emphasis on third downs on both sides of the ball, right? You just touched on the offense trying to keep drives alive to keep their defense on the field. Conversely, on the other side, and I know you touched on this, Mississippi State had the ball way too long in the first half because you guys weren't getting off the field on third downs.
Right, and that issue is spread throughout all three phases. It's a defensive issue insofar as we need to get off the field. You know, the two scores late are so disappointing because it just felt like, I just wanted to finish better competitively, but I felt like in the early and middle stages of the game, we were battling on defense, and part of defending against an air raid team that is a ball control passing offense, you have to have a little patience. You have to pick and choose your moments to pressure. And I felt like we were able to get them off schedule. Even after, you know, they converted first down or they were moving the ball, we were able to get them off behind the chains. Those drives need to end up in field goals. not touchdowns. And if we can just do something to possess the ball on special teams, obviously not get the roughing the punter penalty, and then offensively just string together some first downs, you're going to be in a tight game just by nature of the fact that, you know, their offense, it wasn't necessarily explosive plays. It was methodical drives. If you can be methodical on our end, then all of a sudden, again, you have a tight game in the fourth quarter, and now you're able to apply some pressure. We just weren't able to do that. And, you know, and then those little things build up to big things, and, you know, the Mississippi State's able to separate. So these are the throws, right? This is the pain of the early stages, and we have to be able to rally back and come back Saturday to compete against Missouri.
We're talking to Coach Clark Lee, Vanderbilt Commodores. They've got Missouri coming up on Saturday. And, Coach, I know there's been a number of games this year where the defense has given up an early score or two and then settled in and started to play pretty well. What is it about the first drive that's challenging? I know some teams script plays. There's some times where maybe you don't see what's coming. What is challenging in general about the first drive of a game when you're facing an offense and then maybe, you know, as specific to your team?
Well, you're going to have to defend rhythm because scripts are designed to create rhythm. And so, you know, again, getting teams off schedule on that first drive is huge. If you look at South Carolina, the first drive, we had them at a 3rd and 7. Now, it would have ended up in a field goal attempt, but I felt like we took on some water there early on, got them to 3rd and 7, and to be honest, it felt like a pass completion that was going to one player that was overthrown and just so happened to find another player on right at about the 2-yard line who made the reception, and that was unfortunate. The second series was about, you know, a 2nd and 17, 80-something yard touchdown pass, explosive, and it was just a lack of execution on that, or a lack of awareness on that snap, and good design on their end, not to take anything away. You know, Saturday's game against Mississippi State in the first drive, it felt like, you know, we were bleeding out yards on the perimeter. But if you remember, the first play of the game was we covered the receivers. We set up a 2nd and 8 off a quarterback scramble. The second play of the game is they threw a perimeter screen into 5-under, 3-deep zone, meaning that there shouldn't be a play there for them. They execute a block, and we're just a step slow because of our eyes in the wrong place, and it leaks out to set up 3rd and 2. And even on 3rd and 2, we hit the ball in the backfield, but we're a step behind it, and it's able to fall forward rather than tackle. So I think part of the issue in our early drive, you know, failure has been adapting to the speed of the game. So, like, you know, we have to do a better job of training our defense against our number one offense. You know, I think sometimes in our scout work, which is important, you're defending, you know, redshirt players, you know, and walk-on players, and you're getting the structure and aligning to the formations you're going to see, but you're not getting the vertical pressure or the horizontal pressure of the speed of the play. And so as we look at it, we say, okay, how do we perform better early in games? Let's adapt to the speed of the game sooner, and let's understand how challenging those perimeter throws can be, you know, if we're not setting edges on the perimeter and closing the gaps inside out with our eyes. And again, there was a number of plays where, you know, we're just a couple steps short from a tackle at the line of scrimmage that then becomes us chasing down a ball in an 8-yard gain. And that's not going to be a formula to get an early stop.
Clark Lee is with us. And, Coach, I want to ask you about Will Shepherd. We've been noticing him really all year. I think I asked you, you know, after the first game, it was noticeable how his role had jumped up. Another 100-plus yard game Saturday, rather. But I was reading about him, and it's interesting how he was not really a highly touted guy coming out of high school. And I know you weren't involved in that recruiting process, but even at the end of last year, he wasn't really playing a whole lot. It's interesting how a path of a guy can go with his development. But it would seem that at a place like Vanderbilt, you need guys who maybe weren't as high talented, they're a little off the beaten path, that you discover and develop, those are critical for the development of the program.
Certainly. I think that Barton Simmons, obviously becomes a big part of our staff and a big part of our future here, the organization. And I intentionally hired an industry insider to to someone who has full awareness of, and Barton and I for years talked about recruiting rankings, because there's perception and there's reality. And I think a lot of what's consumed in college football, particularly in college recruiting, is based off perception. Guys get ranked for whatever reason. They could be freshmen that they're outpacing their competition, and they get a ranking tabbed on them, and that kind of validates them as being recruitable. You're dealing with 14 and 15 year old kids, and by the time you're measuring a 40 time, that 4 or 5 star player may be running at a 4.95 as a linebacker, and you're like, wait a second, this doesn't translate to elite play. What are the things that are missed in that process that's really packaged for fan consumption? Those recruiting sites aren't built to direct roster decisions. They're built to create excitement around fans of the game. And what you notice in the recruiting rankings is, whereas a college coach has one opportunity to offer a scholarship, and for us, once we offer it, we obviously will get offers out where, it's at a certain point your class fills up, but on the whole, you offer and you commit a player, and that player is in your family, is committed. The recruiting services will continue to evaluate, because the next measure that they're judged upon is how their rankings, played out in the NFL draft, right? So, like, they want to see success rate in the ranking of their high school prospects relative to first and second round draft picks. So, whereas you might commit a player as a junior, or in some cases as a sophomore in high school, and your evaluation's finished, he's a part of your team, that evaluation continues on the industry side so that they can, have the best possible shot at projecting, what the NFL draft's going to look like. Kyle Hamilton at Notre Dame's a great example of this. When we started recruiting Kyle Hamilton, who's going to be one of the top defensive players in the draft this year, He was an unknown player, two-way player in Atlanta, and soon thereafter he was highly sought after, and then by the end of the cycle he was a five-star player. That's an evaluation and a projection, and you have to be able to do that to have a hit rate, develop the relationships, understand the skills that project. We need speed on this team, and so we have to make sure we're measuring speed in the recruiting process. We might give up a little bit of size or a little bit of a weight to make sure that we have fast players in this class, knowing that we'll build out frames through our strength program. Those are certainly things we look at, and Will Shepard's an example of a guy that is still a young player and is still developing. And when we watch him, it's like, yeah, he's an effective player right now, but, man, could he be really good if we continue to get him to develop within our systems. And so that's the formula here. And, it's kind of exciting as we're going to watch this play out over time, but we feel like we have a really good grip on the characteristics that project to development, and excited to watch how this team grows over time.
Clark Lee is with us, Vanderbilt football coach. And we saw Mike Wright and Jeremy Musa play quarterback against Mississippi State, but how is Ken Seals doing and healing up, and what do you think about your quarterback room overall now that all three have really gotten a chance to play?
Yeah, it's Ken's getting better, and we're gonna see how he proceeds this week. Wasn't able to practice last week, and so not able to play. But once we can get Ken out and get him throwing the ball, we can see how quickly he can get to 100%, so he can get back out there for us. And play. Mike had a great start against South Carolina, and I think probably, we came out of Saturday against Mississippi State feeling like there were some we wanted back. That's natural. You got a young player that's growing into a role. He's got skills. We got to continue to design around his skills. And, you know, I was really excited about the explosive we hit on the second series. I wish that we could have scored that, and we should be able to there. But there are things to build around, and then there are ways that he can get the ball out of his hand faster and on time, and we can utilize what we consider to be a strength of our team, and that's our receivers, as well as tight end Ben Bresnahan. So there are things that we need to do and reads that need to be made so that he can deliver the ball on time, and we can maximize, again, the strength of our offense. I thought Jeremy did a great job coming in at the end and doing just that. You know, he got the ball out on time. We were able to get some completions, get a first down. He had a completion to Amir on the sideline that got defended and was incomplete. But I just felt like he did a nice job coming in with confidence, making the reads, going quickly with the ball where it needed to go based off the coverage. And I think there's something to build on there, too. So those guys will be ready to carry the lion's share of the work. We're going to keep rehabbing Kenny and getting him back to 100%. And once he is, we'll be excited to see him back out there with some new perspective, you know, having hit the pause button here for a couple weeks.
Well, good luck against Missouri, Clark. And thanks, as always, for joining us. We always appreciate the conversations. We'll do it again next week.
Look! It's great to be with you. Looking forward to it, and you guys take care.
Thank you. Clark Lee, Vanderbilt football coach, joins us every Tuesday at 1. We'll come back with Mitch Light of The Athletic and talk college football with him. That's next. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN, 105 The Game.
Back here on Darren Donick and Chase. You know it's a Predators game day. Our game day broadcast brought to you from Bridgestone Arena, brought to you by Hermitage Design Center. Darren Donick and Chase, our show presented by Creation CBD, Creation CBD, products curated for life. Mitch Light from The Athletic. We talk a little college football with him following Clark Lee of Vanderbilt every Tuesday on the show. Mitch, how you doing?
I'm good, Darren. Hope you're doing well.
Yeah, yeah. We got a loaded schedule this weekend, don't we? Last weekend, not so much, but some intriguing games this weekend.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. And, you know, as we say, even when the schedule, that's one thing about college football. Like in the NFL, if it's not a great schedule, there's a finite amount of games. I mean, I guess there's a finite amount of college football games, but when there's like 30 or 40, there's always going to be something crazy like Penn State, Illinois. You don't think you're going to see overtime game. You
know, please tell me you were watching that. I was.
I believe I was on my way home from my son's baseball game, checked my phone, saw it was an overtime, figured I was going to miss the end, got home, put my keys down, my wallet down. I figured, okay, game will be over. Like, still had another half hour to go.
I know. So, you know, we talked about this yesterday. How many people do you think really know the new overtime rules?
More people now than did before.
Yeah. Right. I know.
I think you're right. I think people learned
there's
that day.
No doubt about that. But I'm sure if you're watching it, you're like, what in the heck is going on, right? I bet a lot of people did that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, I was there to be entertained. If I had a interest in one of those two teams and didn't think it was the fairest way to settle it, maybe I'd have a different opinion. But I thought it was entertaining. The thing that was dumb, in my opinion, they give the teams the option which side of the field they want to play, but the switching sides of the field, you know, they talk about player safety and limiting the amount of plays, which in theory, even though that went 9 overtimes, Nicole Auerbach from The Athletic has a story on that today about how it achieved the goal because they didn't have as many plays as the normal overtime. But making these guys walk the length of the field, and, you know, Brett Bielema joked, he's like, I'm not in the best of shape there. I was having a tough time walking down the sideline. So I would have liked to see them, you know, stay in the same end zone. It would have been a little quicker there, but I thought it was entertaining.
So Michigan State, 11 a.m. kickoff in East Lansing. I think it's really intriguing. Obviously, Michigan is off to the 7-0 start. So is Michigan State. How do you think this one ultimately plays out? Because we've seen some wild finishes in the past between these two teams when it comes to this rivalry game.
Yeah, a quick story on that is, I mean, you guys might know, as Willie knows, my wife, Heather, is a Michigan State grad, and I was doing, and the game you're referring to was the errant punt. I mean, that's still one of the most amazing finishes in sports you'll see. I remember it was after Vanderbilt. I was doing sidelines for Vanderbilt. I was in the Vanderbilt locker room after a loss to South Carolina, and like that's one of the oldest locker rooms. The equipment used to never work there. I'm trying to get the equipment working. in my phone. I get like 5 or 6 texts in a row, and my kids were younger. Heather's texting me, so I'm figuring something's wrong, like, you know, with my kids. And she's like, oh my God, state this, blah, 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 block punt. Like, I had no idea what was going on. I just looked at my phone. I was like, something crazy just happened, but I didn't know until later how crazy that was. But, yeah, I mean, this is a fun rivalry. You know, when you think Big Ten rivalries, obviously it's in-state, it's a big deal, but you think more Michigan, Ohio State, recently Penn State, Ohio State, you know, Iowa, Wisconsin. So, but, yeah, I think it's great when you have in-state rivals like this that are, you know, ranked this high, top 10 matchup, national, well, every game's on national TV, but you get it. You know, Michigan State's interesting because they deserve their ranking, but they, you know,
they haven't played anybody.
Well, they were fortunate to beat Indiana 20-15. I'm looking at their ledger here. Extremely fortunate to beat Nebraska, where they had like 10 total yards in the second half, something like that.
Yep.
Beat Miami by 21 points, but that was an anyone's game until the fourth quarter. So Michigan's probably been the more impressive team, but it's at Michigan State, and Michigan State keeps finding ways to win. I mean, if I had to make a pick right now, I'd probably take Michigan, but I'm looking forward to watching this one.
Intriguing one with Ole Miss at Auburn. How do you see that one playing out? Because I'm intrigued on that one Saturday night.
I mean, basically, I think you could just use the word intriguing for every SEC West game.
Yes.
I mean, I'm serious. Like, they're just all – no one's bad. A couple teams we think are really good, but Alabama is, you know, the best team, but they're not – clearly they're not, like, unbeatable. Auburn has been quietly pretty good. You know, the Penn State game probably could have gone either way. There's, you know, a lot was made of the questionable fourth down call, that fade there. No shame in losing to Georgia. Even, you know, they were, I would say, relatively competitive compared to what everyone else is doing. You go to Arkansas, you win. You go to LSU, you win that game. You know, we kind of lost faith in this team when they were fortunate to beat Georgia State, but they're quietly going about their business. But, you know, Ole Miss has been extremely impressive. I thought last week, you know, maybe they got LSU at the right time, you know, after LSU kind of played their best game, its best game of the year in that Florida game, that they were a little flat. But, you know, Ole Miss has been extremely impressive. You know, the defense has been a lot better. You know, look at, other than, you know, they gave 42 to Alabama, 51 to Arkansas, but other than that, everyone else 26 points or less. So I think Ole Miss is the better team. I'm looking forward to, just again, every SEC West game intrigues me. I'm looking forward to watching them all, pretty much.
Talking to Mitch Light, and Mitch, let's talk about, we just talked to Clark Lee, and of course he's still trying to get the foundation. You know, they took a what appeared to be a step forward in having the game in their hand at South Carolina, and then the step back against Mississippi. I'm looking at Wake Forest. Now, this is a team that, you know, Vanderbilt could model themselves. Clark Lee, I believe, was at Wake Forest for a while. Here they are at 7-0. They're a heavy favorite against Duke. You know, you look at the rest of the schedule, UNC, NC State, Clemson, BC. You know, I somebody will probably get them along the way, but they're putting together a really, really nice season. For them, it's, you can count on one hand how many times, you know, they really can get into the mix here of the discussion of a one or two loss type of season. What have they done right? Why are they so good this year?
Slow build. And I was curious because I saw a stat about some of the worst offensive teams like in the last 20 years. Someone tweeted out the other day, and one of them was Wake Forest. And this is interesting because their numbers are so prolific this year. 2014. Dave Clawson's first year, which coincided with Derek Mason's first year at Vanderbilt, I think Wake Forest averaged like 212 yards per game, which is just awful. It's, like I said, it's one of the worst in this century. And they've had, you know, a slow build. They you know, to steal a term from college basketball, mid-majors, you hear, you want to get old and stay old. They have done that. And they have mastered it this year with the super seniors. They had, I don't know the number off the top of my head, but they had a ton of guys come back for a sixth year. I bet if you pulled up their depth chart right now of their 44, they're two deep. My guess is 80% of them are in their fourth year, fifth year, or sixth year in the program. They've got a good quarterback in Sam Hartman. That obviously helps. We've seen some of the better Vanderbilt teams. It's because the quarterback has been good. And look, they lost Kenneth Walker, who's at Michigan State, was in the Heisman discussions, an All-American running back. So, you know, they've had decent skill. They've hit on some quarterbacks. You know, in recent years, they've always had good quarterback play. They've had some good wide receivers as well. Surratt from a few years ago. And I think Dave Clawson's an outstanding coach. He's a great talent evaluator. You look at the recruiting rankings, they consistently are in the bottom five of Power Five programs. But they just, again, they develop, they recruit the kids, the right kids for their program. They develop, and then when you do it like that and you have consistency in your program, you're going to hit every 3, 4, 5 years, you're going to hit the sweet spot, the perfect storm. You got the right quarterback and maybe that veteran offensive line. And another thing that they've done, Dave Clawson's made good hires. They've lost some really good coaches because other schools have come in and paid them more. Like Mike Elko, who is now the defensive coordinator at Texas A&M, was Clark Lee's boss at Wake Forest. Notre Dame offered him more money to go there than Texas A&M offered him even more money. So he is he's very well respected, Clawson is, and he continues to hire good coaches.
And Dave Clawson would be on the list, and it's a long list, of coordinators, coaches that Tennessee has run out of town. It just, and I don't say that to single out Tennessee, because it happens to a lot of coaches. Coaches, a big failure in one place and a huge success in another. We've talked about, you know, some people that have been on James Franklin's staff that had a great amount of success on the Vanderbilt staff and then not so much at Penn State, that type of thing. It's amazing how that dynamic is always out there.
Yeah, and, you know, he was on Phil Fulmer's last staff, so the staff got fired. But, you know, I think that hurt. I mean, I think you've asked SEC fans about Dave Clawson. They chuckle and say, oh, well, you know, he was at Tennessee, he was terrible. But he's been good wherever he's been. He's been a head coach at Fordham, Richmond. Now, he left Richmond, had a great program at Richmond, or was building a great program to take that, you know, offensive coordinator job at Tennessee, which he probably thought would lead to bigger and better things. That didn't work out. Went to Bowling Green, did a very good job at Bowling Green, a difficult place to win. And then, you know, Wake Forest, 2014, 1-7 in the ACC, 2015, 1-7, then 3-5, 4-4, 3-5, 4-4, 3-4, now 4-0. It's just, they found the right guy for their school, and I think he's one of those guys who likes where he is. You don't see his name on any lists, really. Not that he wouldn't be successful somewhere else, it just seems to be the right fit for him.
We were talking about just recruiting philosophies. Clark Lee was bringing up Barton Simmons, and I know you've been following the recruiting scene a lot, Mitch, with some podcasts that you do. I know it's hard right now to sell the program at Vanderbilt right now, but what are you seeing any movement in the philosophy, the type of inroads that they're making in the early stages here with their quest to build the roster?
Well, yeah, and it's interesting about recruiting. It's picking up nationwide, I'd say it's picking up. There's been more commitments nationally in the past 2 or 3 weeks than there were in the first month of the season. For whatever reason, maybe just because of the pandemic and then everything opened back up, there were so many commitments in the summer. There weren't. Vanderbilt was like a lot of schools. They got most of their commitments in their class over the summer, and I don't believe they've had one since the season started. But I think there's been one decommitment since the season started. Kid from Chattanooga, Baylor, I believe. So they're going about it the way they kind of said they would, and the way Wake Forest goes about it. They're just identifying guys that they think are good fits. They're clearly developmental. Most of them are developmental guys, looking for a lot of length on defense. That was something Derek Mason was very big on too. Selling early playing time, which seems to be I don't say it's a contradiction, but you're recruiting guys who you know you need to develop, but you're also, I guess, some of the better players, you're selling them on, you know, coming in with the chance to play right away. But it's difficult. I mean, they have their philosophy. They have they're confident in what they're doing, but they're also struggling on the field, and they're trying to sell these kids on their vision, and they're just hoping that kids can look past the struggles on the field. Hey, we've seen Vanderbilt's not alone trying to recruit players while your season's not going well. If kids only, you know, how would some of these struggling programs fill up their classes if kids only signed places at one? So it's obviously things would be going better for them probably if they were winning games, but it's probably, I don't think it deterred them or changed their philosophy at all.
Mitch Light is with us from The Athletic. All right, Mitch, I want to play the what-if game when it comes to the college football playoff, because this has been a fun year with, you know, some upsets and different teams, new blood. Right now, you obviously have Georgia, Alabama, Oklahoma that are in the top four, Cincinnati being being the number two ranked team. But let's play the what-if game of the Big Ten cannibalizes itself like it appears could happen with Michigan, Michigan State playing each other. Obviously, Ohio State has to play them, and you take them out. I believe Oklahoma stumbles at some point. They've been playing with fire all year long. Then I think somewhere down the line, they stumble. Is there a scenario in your mind where another SEC team other than Georgia and Alabama, let's say one of them doesn't make it because of a stumble, could Ole Miss or Kentucky be in this mix before it's all said and done?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot there. But first of all, I think Ohio State's going to make the playoff. I mean, I know this is a hypothetical. I don't think they're going to be part of the cannibalization. I think that's a program that has righted the ship, and they are playing unbelievably well on offense right now. But to specifically answer your question, I think Ole Miss would have the better chance because of its strength of schedule. Yeah. And there's really not a... You know, Arkansas might, whoever finishes in last in the West isn't going to have a great record, but that's still a good team. The problem is for someone like Kentucky, they've already lost to Georgia, so they missed, you know, which is obviously no shame. You've missed the opportunity. With Florida kind of struggling, that's not a great win. Tennessee's a solid team, but it's not a top 25 team right now. And then you got Missouri and Vanderbilt, who have been two of the worst Power 5 teams. So, That's a much tougher sell to me. You know, a Kentucky team, let's say they went 11-1 and didn't win the West, and they're sitting at, didn't win the East, and they're sitting at home for the SEC championship game. Ole Miss has a much better case, even with probably two losses, because of the teams they would have beaten, the teams they would have played.
So, do you think the committee, even if Alabama loses to Georgia in the SEC title game with two losses, does that still keep them in, or do you think it knocks them out?
Well, it just, I mean. It's a good question, but it just depends what happens. You know, what happens to Ohio State? What happens if, like the scenario you said, where Oklahoma stumbles? How competitive is that game? You know, Alabama already beating Ole Miss. If Ole Miss is the team that's in third or in second in the West, and it's an Alabama-Ole Miss argument, then will Alabama beat them head to head? Not that that's everything, but then if it's Texas A&M, then you got Texas A&M already beat Alabama, or was the one team that beat Alabama. So. A lot of scenarios there, but I'm a big believer in not just wins and losses, but how do you look, especially in a championship game, if you're gonna, you know, put a team in that just lost a championship game. If they lose 24-3 and look bad offensively because Georgia makes everyone look bad offensively, that's a lot different than losing 24-21 and playing well.
So, do you agree or disagree on Oklahoma? And I say that they're going to stumble.
Yeah, I think they might stumble, but still win the Big 12. Off the top of my head, I'm sure you know they've already played Texas. They still have Oklahoma State, Bedlam.
They have Baylor, Iowa State, Oklahoma State are the three big ones, and then Texas Tech this weekend.
Yeah, I would, if I were a betting man, which I'm not to the degree you are. I'm a slightly, you know, like to dabble every once in a while. I would bet that more likely they're going to have at least one loss than go undefeated the rest of the way. A little alarming, the Kansas game. Now, they won at the end. They unbelievable play by Caleb Williams there. But, you know, we kind of thought they righted the ship with Caleb Williams taking over and all that, and then to be down in the fourth quarter at Kansas is not a good look. Again, they won the game, but this is not a vintage Oklahoma team where we're used to seeing them. We're used to seeing them blow everyone out and then stumble against a Kansas State or an Iowa State. This team's different. They're just finding ways to win all the close games.
I love the tweet that Kansas put out there. It was as if, you know, hey, you know, you didn't think we had a chance, but hey, we're winning. The gates are open. Come on down. If you're in the area, just come on in.
That reminded me, Willie, I don't know if you remember where you were. You might have been doing basketball-related activities. The first game I ever covered for the Vanderbilt Hustler was my freshman year. I think it was 2 or 3 weeks into our freshman year, Willie, and Vanderbilt was playing Alabama. And I think it was pouring rain.
Pouring.
At Vanderbilt Stadium. And I don't remember the details, but Vanderbilt came back and was coming back in the fourth quarter. And, you know, from the press box, you can see the student entrance over there. And I just remember seeing waves of people coming back into the stadium. And I don't want to say if this isn't – I'll have to apologize to Corey Harris later if this is not true. I think Corey Harris, who at that point was a wide receiver, missed a – dropped the ball in the end zone in the pouring rain that would have won the game or given Vanderbilt the lead late. But – that's something I'll always remember.
Oh, yeah. They were way behind. John Gromos was the quarterback. They were down 20-0. I left at halftime because I was getting soaked. I went back to my freshman dorm and then was told that the comeback was on. I listened on the radio. Could
have
won.
I'll have to look at the details in that about if it was Corey Harris dropped the pass. Gary Hollingsworth is the name from the pass, the quarterback for Alabama, I believe.
That was a good Alabama team, by the way.
Yeah, yeah. So that was and then I know we got to go soon. Next year I went down to Alabama, and it was Alabama, I think, started the season 0-2, 0-3 under Gene Stallings, and then I think it was 56-0 Alabama at the half. There was no comeback, but that game was noted for Derek Gragg, who is now the athletic director at Northwestern, caught three touchdowns, the only three touchdowns, I believe, of his career in that game.
Mitch, appreciate it as always. Have a great week. We'll do it again next week.
Hey, Darren, you don't want me and Willie to talk about 1989, 90?
Pick a year. Pick a year. 1993, 95, 97. We were there.
You have to leave them wanting more. You can pick it up next week.
That's why you're the best, Darren.
Mitch, thank you as always. Mitch Light from The Athletic. Willie, you're going to tell everybody about Lee Company.
Well, first let me tell you about 1999 Vanderbilt football. No, okay.
99. Last time the Braves were in the World
Series. I see where Jay's going.
And the Titans were in the Super Bowl.
Oh, that's right. That was a great year in 99. Okay, let's talk to you about Lee Company before we come back with our final segment. Lee Company is a big sponsor of Nashville Predators hockey, and they've got all the services lined up for you. Today, let's talk about general maintenance for you. Maintenance at your home or at your business. You need some help. You're not Mr. Handyman. I know I'm not Mr. Handyman, but Lee Company's always right there at your service. They're a phone call away or an online appointment. Yeah, you can go to LeeCompany.com, make the online appointment while you're at work, continue the work. They'll come take care of the problem. You're free to go to the Predators game or anything that you choose because they will take care of what you need, whether it's door issues, maintenance issues, anything you can think of. Let them come help take care of the problem. Also, you can call them at 615-567-1000. We talk about this type of season. It's starting to get a little cooler. You might start running that heat, especially at night. If it's not running well, call them now before it really gets into the cold months and you're constantly running it. 615-567-1000 for Lee Company. Or go to LeeCompany.com. Lee Company, let their decades of expertise go to work for you.
Darren Donahue can chase on this Tuesday afternoon. We're excited to be here at Patron Platinum Club. It means the Predators have a game tonight. You know what that means. 7:30 start, remember that. 7:30 start against the Sharks. Pete Weber and Hal Gill will have your call when they drop the puck. I'll have pregame at 6:30. Everything heard right here on these airwaves. Our game day broadcast here from Bridgestone Arena is brought to you by Hermitage Design Center. Don't know what we were talking about.
I'm trying to find out, but getting a hold of people today has been difficult. So I guess we got a lot of meetings going on.
Okay.
There's a lot of meetings going on in Chicago right now.
Yes, there are. Yes, there are.
Let's just go on and do this. Text in the keyword stadium. No?
Just
wait? Okay.
Yeah, I'm trying to find out.
Hold.
We're in a holding pattern.
Hold, please. We got holding.
Well, while we keep holding.
Repeat first down.
The Blackhawks have been fined $2 million for inadequate procedures and mishandling of their 2010 matter. 2010?
Yeah.
Related back to the conduct of former video coach Brad Aldrich. They have let go Stan Bowman.
Yep. Or he's resigned.
He has resigned. He has released a statement. They've had a long press conference starting at the top of this hour.
But there could be a major trickle-down effect.
That's what people are wondering is what is the next part of this. Meanwhile, the Blackhawks have had a miserable start to their season on the ice, and now you throw this on top of it. I don't know. I have followed the story loosely. I didn't know exactly what type of impact that this would have today, but man, this is a sledgehammer.
Mm-hmm. So Chase, text, is that what we're doing? We're not going to do a question?
Yes.
Okay. All right, we've got clarification. Let's go to Ed on our phone line driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com.
Hey, guys. Thanks for taking the call. Listen, I appreciated the guest before, but look, I think we're all sleeping. I think all of college football is sleeping on Oregon. Oregon, and I'm listen, I'm an SEC guy, but there is nobody in college football with a better win than Oregon. They go to Ohio State, and they beat they beat them by 7. They're actually up by more than that, guys. And you look up and down the SEC, there's nobody with a better win on the road than Oregon. They only have one loss. I think they're going to win out. There is no way you can take Ohio State over Oregon, and they beat them at their place. There is absolutely no way you can do that. Not in my opinion. What do you guys think about that? Well, Oregon is a really, really good football team.
Yeah, that hiccup, though, was a bad loss. That was a really bad loss.
But this is an ancient discussion on shows like ours. We were just joking about pick a year in the 90s. Mitch and I will tell you about every game for Vanderbilt football. But pick a year, any year, and there's always the philosophical discussion. What's more valuable, a great win, or does a bad loss outweigh a great win? I think the weight of a great win can overcome one hiccup. One hiccup.
And you're going to lose all that if they expand, or when they expand, not if, when. But this conversation we're having, and I'm pro-expansion, maybe not to 12, but I'm pro-expansion. But this conversation right here of, well, what if this happens, and what about this team or what have you, it goes away with 12. Because, right now, if you look at the top 12 going on the AP top 25, the teams that, cannibalizing themselves, which will still happen, but Michigan, Michigan State, they'd be in. Oregon would be in. Ole Miss would be in. Kentucky would be in. Notre Dame would be in.
Well, I think the same discussion would happen. It just would happen a little bit lower on the totem pole, and you might be talking about one great win versus two different losses.
The first college football playoff is always going to be
a big thing.
Polls come out a week from today, so next Tuesday night will be our first release. Now, to Ed's point. There is nobody. He's right. There's nobody in the country that's
got
a better.
Yeah,
there's nobody that's got a better win than at Columbus beating Ohio State.
Yeah.
Now Stanford is not awful. They're not awful.
No.
But and it was on the road. But they lost to Stanford. And what was it, like a Friday night game? I was watching a little bit. They got down 14-0 to UCLA. Now they came back and they won, 34-31. To them running the table, Colorado, probably win. Washington, Washington State, Utah. The Oregon State one, right? That could be interesting.
Always tricky.
Final game of the year, the big rivalry. That could be tricky. But, can they run the table? Yeah, they can. So he's asking the question, okay, what if Kentucky's got one loss? What if Ohio State's got one loss? What if Alabama has one loss? What if Georgia has one loss? I guess how are you going to decide?
And there's a long way to go. There's still a lot of teams that have no losses, but they won't have a win as impressive as at Ohio State. Ohio State, of course, has got to keep winning. Michigan versus Michigan State, that's one.
It could be
very interesting. The winner of that game is going to be like, okay.
Yep, and they could end up with one loss. So, there's a long ways to go. I'm not disputing anything that he asked, but let's wait a little bit because there's still so much more that has to be played out. Text in the keyword stadium right now. Stadium to
615-737-1025,
and you'll have a chance to be entered to win a pair of tickets to the 2022 Navy Federal Credit Union NHL Stadium Series. That'll be, of course, over at Nissan Stadium on February 26th when the Predators host the Lightning. Be a part of the 70,000 fans that'll be screaming very, very loud. It's going to be an awesome day. And, man, what a great spectacle it's going to be over at Nissan Stadium. By the way, you can buy your tickets right now at nhl.com/stadium-series-tickets. That will do it for our show today. Predators and Sharks tonight. Have a great rest of your Tuesday. Continue to be safe, and we look forward to talking to you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. Stay tuned. Stillman & Company is next.